The gifts are all yours at JCPenney's Happy Birthday Sale. Celebrate with 30% off select Levi's for the fam. Plus, save up to 50% during our biggest home sale of the season. Oh, and this Saturday only, the first 120 customers in-store get a coupon for $10 off a $10 purchase. Shopping is back. JCPenney. Levi's offer ends 4/17. Additional offers and coupons do not apply. Home offer ends 4/9. Coupon giveaway in-store only. Exclusions apply. Valid 4/9. Must be 18 or older. See store or jcp.com for details.
Guys, if you haven't checked up on our social media recently, what have you been doing? I'm at Nick Hardwick, and Jamie is at jamie.hardwick. That's J-A-Y-M-E with a period, and then Hardwick, which is not to be confused with the other Jamie Hardwick, who I tagged a little while ago on Instagram, and she notified me that you may want to get this straight, bud. Your wife may be pissed at you. That earned me the Worst Husband of the Week award. Sorry, babe. Anyway, you guys know that Lose Like Alignment is going off. I'm sure you've seen some of the ads circulating. Hundreds of men now are losing staggering amounts of weight on a daily basis. It's been so awesome to see. And of course, I had no idea that life would turn into this for me or for us. I just had to get the information out of my head, share it with others, see if it could help people reclaim their lives. And lo and behold, it has. And I am just really grateful to be a part of this amazing team. And the most fulfilling thing for me and the program is the weekly interactions that we get through the accountability network. So sign up for that. It is awesome to get personal connections and have conversations and get to understand who people are, what their challenges are, and assist on a very personal basis, on a weekly basis. So as this was all going on, we're getting crazy amounts of requests from the ladies wondering if this program is good for them too. And for me, I said, sure, yeah, it is. But really, since the beginning, I've tried to get Jamie to give my plan a try, and she would try it for a day or two and then basically tell me it wasn't for her. And finally, listening to the requests on social media and through email for a female version, and then getting some feedback back from females who were actually in the program and taking that into account, and then asking and not telling Jamie what could make this plan work for her and for other females, she went, took the parts from the men's program that she liked, modified it to accommodate the female body and your guys' individual preferences, and gave it a try. And I tread lightly saying this to her. Thankfully, she's not around right now. But it's been super cool watching her own this program. She has gained control back over the food, has reset her hunger cues, and has lost the weight she's been trying to lose really forever. I know. Believe me, I don't think she has anything to lose either, but still, she's getting to a place where she feels great about her body, and that is important. In fact, I just get out of the bathroom, and she says, I've lost this weight, but Nick, I've lost an inch off of my waist. She's taken measurements. So we sent the adjustments back to our design team, and voila, the Lose Like a Lady program is born. We would love for you guys to join the team. If you want to know more, all food preferences and eating styles work within the framework we provide in both the men's and the women's program. We do provide body weight only workouts and daily activities known as every hour on the hour exercises, EHO. But guess what? As we tell everyone, the exercise is the least important component of the plan. It's not required to lose weight. If you don't want to exercise, or you've got your own form of exercise that you would rather do, do that. We are never going to discourage that. This program will help you figure out what works best for you. You're going to learn appropriate caloric loads for the day and per meal. You're going to learn how to match your caloric intake with daily activity levels. You're going to break free from the having to eat a meal every 3 hours cycle. It really is an incredibly empowering experience. Also, the program helps build healthy self-care habits that make the program sustainable for life. And it's wonderful when you figure out that the more you take care of yourself, the healthier, the easier it is to make good choices when it comes to food, when it comes to exercise. And the best part about the program that a lot of people find is it's 4 weeks on and 2 weeks off of the plan. That is what we call a diet break. How many programs encourage you to not do the diet? We do that so you're going to build trust with yourself. You're going to take the skills you learned and you're going to put them to test in the real world. The whole process, it's incredibly empowering. When you reclaim your health, you really do reclaim your life. Join our teams. Sign up at hardwick.life. It's like hardwick.com, but hardwick.life. And use the code podcast20 for 20% off the order. And by the way, you can use that code forever on anything site-wide forever. And we want you to know that we're here for you. You can email me directly at nick@nickhardwick.com. I do. I get back to everybody. Try it. Try me. I'll get back to you. Anything you have, show recommendations, any questions, any support, any criticism, we're here for that. Throw everything my way. You need help modifying this program to suit your particular needs? All you got to do is ask. We've helped hundreds of people make this program work in their lives, and you can too. All right, guys, back to the show. Check it out, hardwick.life, podcast 20 for 20% off, and we hope to see you on the network soon. Love you guys.
What's up, Mark? Brother?
How are you?
I am, you know what? I'm phenomenal because number one, I'm alive. Number two, I've got 10 of these and 10 of those down below.
And your vision.
And my vision and my side of my face was all wiped out. It looked like, it was weird because it looked like I had a severe sunburn. My whole, like, peeled off my face, was all red, scabby. And that was all from the pellets, like, hitting me. Wow. Up there. Yeah. I ran out of oxygen. I mean, like, everything awful that could have happened all went down.
It's crazy. So we'll back it up. We're recording. If you don't mind, we'll just roll.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Roll.
Yeah. So Mark just got done climbing Mount Everest and you're back in States. How long has it been now?
It's been like 20 days since I stood on top of the world.
And that's crazy to say, 29,032 feet, Mount Everest. Yeah. And you were on top of the world. How long did you get to stay there once you summited? And then we'll back out of that.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, first of all, is I was the last guy up on that mountain. And then there was about seven of us when I joined the other five that were there. And then I stood there, I sat there taking pictures and going through all that for about 45 minutes. And then as it all turned out, I was the last guy coming off the mountain. So I was actually up there exposed for over 18 hours. So, you know, you're a workout freak like I am. And you know, you and I like to get after it. And I can, and at the same time, you and I are not really endurance athletes. We're sprint guys, right? We're,
yes.
You know, fire.
Yeah. You're right? A receiver.
I was a receiver. So we're going like 40 yards down the field and coming back and you're a center. And so you're firing off the line and, you know, pushing forward 5-10 yards. And that's what we're trained to do. And I was out there 18 hours and with nothing to eat. I ate just a little bit of granola going out the door. You know, you do a great job of really fueling yourself. You know, you and I, when we're in Africa together, talked a lot about your diet and what you eat and all that stuff. And I very much mirror the way that you take care of your body. And, you know, essentially for 3 days, I did not eat beyond this freeze dried, awful shit that I was putting in my mouth. And I didn't have much of it.
Was that by design or was that because being at altitude, it was just very difficult to eat or why weren't you fueling?
Yeah, it's just one, I have a problem. My body has a problem with freeze-dried food. B, that's really all you can take up there beyond any candy bar you stuff in your pocket. C, you know, you're so limited on what you can get. So you essentially your Sherpas and other support crew, you know, they're bringing, this is now like at, you know, 23,500 feet at Camp 3. You know, we're sitting, we've got these tents pitched on a 45 degree slope. Which was terrifying itself. And then going from there to high camp, Camp 4 at 26,500 feet, you're just so limited on what you can bring. And so, you know, everybody's trying to be as thrifty and as light as you possibly can be. And so, you know, the process really is about constantly trying to boil water, which takes a bundle of snow to create just a little liter of water. And then with that hot water, then you're pouring that into the freeze-dried packets. And it's just a really simple way to eat. So I get the simplicity of that, but none of that added to any kind of fuel, which ultimately had a major impact on my well, it turned out to be success, but my really at the end of the day was mega struggles going up that mountain on summit day, trying to get up there.
How much weight did you lose
the whole throughout 25, that? Yeah, 25 pounds.
25 pounds. And what percentage of body weight is that? Because you went there weighing what?
I went there weighing, 204. So, it's a significant amount of weight for me. Because I'm built like a receiver. You look like a receiver now.
12.5% of your body weight. I mean, that's
it's
15%. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the weight I really needed. I really needed to tap in. And, I spent thousands of hours. I live in Sun Valley, Idaho. So I moved here 3 years ago with the commitment of like going all in on these mountains, knowing that the hardest ones were still ahead of me. And I literally went up and down the mountain on skis. It's called skinning, 3,000 feet a shot. 45 times this past winter, gearing up, and I had to literally tap in because I had no fuel. And the weird thing about this is I could literally feel my body eating itself. And that was the most terrifying. And I took a picture. I'm not sure if you saw this. I did see it. Yeah. I was actually embarrassed to show that because I don't show a lot of like gunned up shots, of all the workouts that I do, but so many people have talked about how compelling a picture tells 1,000 words of this side-by-side picture of New York Times took a shot of me the day before I left Kathmandu. And then, essentially 70 days later, what I look like, dropped 25 pounds and getting beat up by all the weather and all the elements up there. And I literally look like when I left, I felt like I looked like I was 39 years old. Like you're still like ripped out and you still look great, and coming off.
Yeah. I watch all your workout. I mean, you get after it now.
I get after it, but I look like I was 79 years old. I mean, my skin was all kind of
coming off the mountain. Yeah,
I did. I was like I said, I was embarrassed because I was looking at this person in the mirror that I hadn't seen myself in, 2 months. And I'm looking at this person, in the mirror back of the hotel, having literally just flown off the mountain in a helicopter. And I'm just like, I look sick, And it's just like, what has this thing done to me?
And we'll get to it. I'm sure it has had a profound impact on the way you see the world, the way you see yourself, your life, all of that. Back us up if you would. How did, because the Instagram handle used to be NFL to Seven Summits, right?
Yeah.
And now it's changed. But when did that thought come to you that I want to be the first guy ever to have played in the NFL to summit the Seven Summits, which if people don't know what that means, it's the seven highest mountains on all of the continents around the world.
Yeah. So obviously there's seven continents. I've now been on all seven continents, and there's some destinations in there that you would never think are part of that continent. Like the highest mountain in Europe is actually in Russia. Right. So it's just, I would never have connected those two together, but answering your question, I went through a rough patch 10 years ago. And during that rough patch, I was at a really low place, and in that low place, my now ex-wife of 24 years, knew her for 30, didn't want to be married anymore, and that it was a really hard thing because it meant breaking up the family. I've got mad respect for you in many different ways and many different levels, and one of the things that I so admire about you is the love that you have for your superstar wife and how involved as a dad and committed you are to those, I think, two boys that you got.
And
you're at all the stuff. And I was that guy. I was the one that was at, I was the coach of everything. I have two girls now, they're 24 and 22. But back in the day, volleyball, soccer, softball, girls basketball. I mean, I was there for, I wasn't just there. I was the coach, right? For all that stuff.
That's right.
And so when all that went sideways, it hurt me so deeply and it was out of control. and something I couldn't control, that I just, you know, we go through rough times. You know, some of us, you know, maybe it's the transition of getting out of the NFL or military, you know, stopping that. And so, you know, I was actually even to the point where, is my life even valuable enough? Like, am I better off not on this earth? You know, I mean, that's a scary place when you start having those kind of thoughts. Yeah. And that's where I was.
And I had that when I first got out of the NFL. It was about 2 months afterwards. And it just seemed like I got hit by a train emotionally and had no idea what was going on. So thank you for sharing that and getting vulnerable. Because it is important for people to understand that while it may not seem normal, it is normal to have those thoughts, to have suicidal thoughts at some point throughout this long life, right? I think 90% of humans have suicidal ideation and 50% of humans have a plan in place. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. And, you know, I've found a lot of crossover with a lot of the, you know, Navy SEALs and other guys that I've met who have that same kind of camaraderie that you and I did. And, you know, it's hard also to like break that down, because, you know, the sport that you and I played in, the NFL and college football, you know, it's a gladiator sport. And so we're the tough guys on the block. And so for us, and people see us in the light, and then all of a sudden they go out and like, who are you and what's your mission and how do you transfer that same energy into something positive? And so this went on for a couple of years, and, you know, finally one day I just said, you know what, I'm done with this. I'm just like, I'm done feeling sorry for myself. And I kept asking the same question, like, how did I get here? And I changed that question to, what am I going to do about it? And at that particular moment, it's just like this energy and this whole idea of a big goal. And so I went, did some research and found that no NFL player had climbed the seven summits at the time. And I said, I'm going to be that guy. And so it changed, you know, where your focus is, your energy a lot of times follows, right? I'm sad, so your energy, right? You droop your shoulders, and I'm jacked up about the certain thing. So, you know, now I'm, you know, it just all has to do with where your mind's at. And so by changing and having a big goal and something that was really, I wouldn't say unattainable, but, you know, it's not like a layup, a simple, you know, it's a stretch goal, right? And so, and so much so that no NFL guy had ever done it. And so I started doing the research, and then that my excitement, because now I'm going to faraway, you know, lands, I'm having to train, I'm having to put all this effort into it. I get to meet, you know, amazing people all over the world, not just in those particular countries, like when you and I came together in Tanzania and going out and being in the Serengeti and meeting these incredible humans, the Maasai tribe, but also the camaraderie of these other climbers on the expedition from all over the world. And when you and I climbed, which is my second time I've been on Kilimanjaro, you know, outside of Jora, there's a whole platter of new dudes and girls. You know, we just had a great time and a great camaraderie, and all these new people that I got to know is really exciting. Yes. So that was really the idea, the impetus of, you know, how I got into this and kind of set me on this path.
It's so tremendous. So are you done with the seven? Have you completed all seven now?
I've completed seven, done 20 days ago. I've done. And I also,
did you save, you intentionally save Everest for last?
Yeah. I mean, it's by far the, you know, you don't go from little league to the NFL in one jump, right? You want to make sure you know the progression because you went through it, but
that's right.
It's the same thing. I'm mountain climbing and really had to hone my game of understanding about learning how to navigate big boy mountains. And big boy mountains means, you know, climbing 60 feet straight up over ice walls, having to rappel off those things, having to deal with avalanches when they're coming down, navigating your way through all the crevasses, you know, 100 feet deep, going across ladders with crampons on your feet, you know, 3-inch spikes, click, 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 you know, as you're going across a 20 foot. I mean, there's all these things you're navigating. And the thing that just takes this to a whole nother level too, is beyond all the things I just said, is every night, you know, for 70 days, you're sleeping in, you know, minus degree temperatures, I never didn't go to sleep where I wasn't on ice. I wasn't sleeping on rocks. I wasn't in a, you know, full beanie. I mean, it looks like I was going on a ski trip, you know, in terms of gloves and everything else. And, you know, it just gets old. It's like hanging in there 6 weeks of two-a-days, you know, where you just got to keep hanging in there and just like, it's don't get caught about 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now. The only thing that matters is what's happening in that moment and what you need to do to survive.
You're forced to live in the moment because I have to imagine as you're describing it, I'm like, so for 70 days and all the travel, by the way, leading up to it. So you're on the mountain for 70 days, but everything kind of leading up to it too is uncomfortable, like, and beyond uncomfortable, right? It's like that. Yes. You have to get to a place in your head that I would imagine for that extended period of time, very few humans have had to go there.
Well, and the wild card that came into play in a big time way was COVID. And so for me, the thing I was like, if you would ask, we would have the same conversation that you would have said at the time, this is back in, you know, March, let's just say you and I, Mark, what's your biggest concern? My biggest concern at that time was not being vaccinated. And so I live here in Sun Valley, Idaho, and I, through the kind of some backdoor ways, I mean, it was like right at the end there, because, you know, there was a shot one from Pfizer and a shot two a month later, right, whenever it was. And so that had to all space out. And I had maybe, I don't know, 7 days to spare when I got my second shot. And so kind of leading up to that, there was a major concern. I had to drive 100 miles away to a small little hospital to get that done. But ultimately, I got that done, and it became a major problem on the mountain for a lot of people. We had a huge COVID outbreak at Mount Everest. We actually had one climber that flew from wherever he flew from into Kathmandu. And then he had somehow or another contracted COVID. And so not only did his thing shut down there, but then the hotel kicked him out. They had to move him to an apartment. And when he got better 2.5 weeks later, I guess he was very sick. The government wouldn't let him out because now he had a quarantine for another 14 days. So that was a nightmare there. And then we make our way up to the mountain. And then Everest Base Camp, which is interesting, at 17,500, other than the like the normal camp that you think that you would be in, like when you and I climbed Kilimanjaro together, we go into the camp and there was the camp, right?
Right.
This camp is like about a mile long as it leads up into the Kumba Icefall. And so what we did is purposely, and again, we're mixing with 35 different Sherpa plus our team of, it started with 19, ultimately ended up down at 11 because 8 quit, got sick, got a bunch of things. But we purposely stayed away from all the other camps. And I knew a lot of people in other camps, but there was such this, you know, this threat of COVID outbreak and people who weren't covered. And whole expedition teams, especially at the end, that were canceling, quitting the entire thing. I mean, I can't imagine, but we kept dodging all that. And somehow or another, we made it through and hit it just right.
Yeah, because, I mean, you think of on a regular expedition to Everest, all the variables that go into it anyhow, right? Mm-hmm. Your health, your fuel, the weather. Are you going to get a summit at the right time? Does the season, you know, all the stars kind of have to align for it to happen anyway. There's a lot of financials that are involved in that. And then throw in the new wild card of COVID. I mean, that had to be kind of perpetual in the back of your mind. It's like, we've in how many years? So you're talking 10 years almost of a ramp up to be good enough and qualified enough and skilled to be able to do this. And then all of a sudden, a little virus can just wreak havoc on it.
And it did. And it really became out of control. Once we ended up at the end, they literally shut the whole country down. So it's a whole nother story that we don't need to go into right now. But it's a whole nother story how I got out of the country. Because when I say they shut everything down, it wasn't, you know, when they shut the many of the states down around here in the U.S., you know, they still had like key things open, like a gas station or, you know, you'd stand in line at Trader Joe's or something, right? But you could still get food and supplies. In Nepal, they shut the whole country down. No flights, zero. No grocery stores, zero. No, I mean, nothing, nothing, nothing. And so, there was yet another wild card that played into all this too, which I don't know if you knew about, but you know, when this is towards the end now, this is as we were preparing to go for summit, a cyclone hit the country of Nepal. And so that was causing massive amount of awful weather on the mountain, tons of snowfall. And that ended up being a reason too why many other expedition parties had to cancel there, because they just didn't pick it. Like you said, you can't, when you're sitting at base camp, it takes about 6 days of pre-planning of trying to predict the weather, what's going to happen, to time it just right. And you had said it perfectly about the timing of how that all works. And so there was this awful weather, the jet stream, which was blown 200 miles, had touched back down on the top, and that was causing havoc and causing all these delays. So a lot of this was just us rolling the dice and saying, I'm predicting on this particular day, which happened to be May 23rd, that it's going to be decent enough weather to allow us safe passage. But we had no idea. And 2 days before that, I was in a tent at 23,500 feet, winds blowing about 60 miles per hour. This is where we're on that slope of 45 degrees, avalanches coming down here. I mean, it was insane. And to think that, you know, 72 hours later, I'd be sitting on top of the world and actually great weather for that particular window. It was just that day, it's half luck. And we just happened to pick that particular day of 6 days before when we started going up that mountain.
Isn't that crazy? How many people that attempt make it? How many people that show up to base camp every year actually reach the summit?
I don't know the answer to that, but I mean, to me, like based on the rough numbers that I heard, I mean, I don't know if more than 30% of the people that actually attempted the mountain, you know, got there for either weather reasons or COVID reasons. I mean, there were helicopters flying in daily, you know, flying COVID sick people off the mountain. And then, so there's that component, there's the weather component. And then like in our group, you know, we started with 19 climbers, and that ultimately of the 19, nine didn't make it of those. And so eight of those people out of the nine, you know, were gone within a month. You know, they just had it. They didn't want to do it. They were.
Did it just warm down?
Yeah, just warm down.
As you're talking about it, and it's almost like I just spent some time recently with some Navy SEALs, and it's almost like of your class, right? The people that showed up, they kind of rang the bell and they said, that's too much in a month deep, and they still had 40 days to go. But that's kind of to your point is, they're probably looking so far in the future and how much they have to go and how uncomfortable they are right now, and they can't get past it. How did you train your mind to get to the place? Because you can't just show up on the mountain and be like, sure, well, let's make this go. How did you train your mind to be able to withstand everything that was thrown at you?
You know, I don't know if you agree, because you've gone through some serious battles. I remember, you know, I don't think you played high school football, and then you like walked on, you know, your college team and at Purdue, and off you went. And then somewhere in there was something in you that created the why of your drive that really made you accelerate to becoming this really good NFL player for the Chargers. And in my case, I believe that the way you, and I learned this from football, the way you create a strong mind is from a strong body. I don't think it's the other way around. And I've climbed with people who've tried to read a bunch of books, and then they think they're physically going to be in, you know, great shape. And that never, I've never seen that really work out. And so that's why I've been committed for years at working out 2 times a day. I'll do it again. Worked out early this morning, do my CrossFit stuff in my home gym, And then I'll go up on the mountain a little bit later with your buddy, Jim Mora. And, you know, I've been committed to doing that and driving myself. We have something here in Sun Valley called skinning. And when you skin, you essentially, there's like a sandpaper type of material you can put on the bottom of your skis. And then you can go up the mountain without slipping back. And then when you get to the top of wherever you're going, you can rip off this skin, this sandpaper type material you put in your backpack, and then you can ski down the mountain. So that's always, you know, a ton of fun. And I did that 45 times this past winter, 3,000 feet a shot. So if you times, you know, 3,000 times 45, that's a lot of vertical feet going up and down that mountain, and doing it in the dark and doing it when it's blown cold out there and everything else with headlamps on. And, you know, I just committed to taking myself to the edge, and I had to use every single one of those chits that were in there. And I think that's on the physical side, which created a stronger mental. But, you know, my daughter also has, she's got epilepsy. And so I've partnered with a group here in Sun Valley called Higher Ground, which help out mainly military people with cognitive and empowering them by coming here, and they fly fish and they ski and mono skis and things like that, and really try to give them where they can fly high. And, you know, as I was going up that mountain, and this was now on the kind of the final hurrah, you know, going up on summit from 26,000 up to 29,000, 32 feet. And I was struggling big time. And I was just like, I'm not quitting. You know, I'd go 10 feet and I'd think about a million. I'd think about what she's gone through since she was 8 years old. She's now 22. And I was just like, she doesn't quit. I don't quit. I'm going another. And then there was just a wave of supporters. You're one of them, that were cheering me on. And I just felt that love and I felt that support. And there were so many people that came in and said, you know, I used to have problems, you know, doing whatever. And they knew about my story. And they said, you're inspiring us to go do something. And so it was just like, I can't quit on them. And so I really had to tap into those things to keep me going, because I wanted to quit. And I just like, I'm not quitting. I would have, like, I was playing these mental games during this whole 18 hours, as I'm snowballing, as I'm getting face whipped, which turned into this huge scar, as I ran out of oxygen coming down the mountain, you know, as we're dealing with all these other elements, stepping over dead bodies, and just committed to just seeing this thing through. Cause I knew that if I could just get to the other side, that, you know, in 12 hours or 18 hours or whenever that was going to be, I was going to sit in some restaurant or some nice place, you know, having a beer, and it would be over. I just had to get to the other side, just like, you know, you with two-a-days, and it's sweltering hot. And, you know, you're like, I feel like throwing up. I can't run another 100-yard, you know, sprint, but you do it, and you just got to get to that other side.
It's incredible. And I tell you, I really appreciated all the posts during the whole journey. It was so fun watching you every day. It's like, where's Mark at now? And it's like walking by yaks, going over the crevasses. I mean, those things were like, it was so scary to me watching. I'm looking on a little 3-inch screen, right? But the one that hit me the hardest was the one on the summit where you're like one step, one breath, one step. And it's just like, you really did such a great job of putting it on paper or putting it on Instagram, and I could feel it, right? I could feel almost the struggle that you were going through trying to get up there, and how arduous that was, and the mental pain that it, fighting up that mountain. I mean, it was pretty daggone impressive.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, my original goal, which I failed at. And there was a gentleman, Craig Hanneman, who played for Oregon State and had a career in the NFL. And in 2019, he ended up becoming the first NFL player to summit all seven. He's maybe 10, 15 years older than me, and he's come down with ALS. And so, you know, he wanted to have this as kind of his last swing. And he made it. And so I had set a goal to like outdo what he had done, which is come climb Everest, come down and Everest at the bottom at 25,000 or 26,500 feet, there's a saddle. And on the other side of it slopes up is the fourth highest mountain in the world called Lhotse. And my goal is to crawl my tent for 4 hours and get out and go climb that. And that's straight up 1,800 feet. And as I was coming down that mountain, and this is now I've run out of oxygen. I'm crawling down the mountain. I'm saying I'm not dying today. Today is not the day that Mark died. I mean, how often do you have those conversations with yourself? And I'm not quitting, and I'm going to do this for Amelia. I'm having all that. I came to my senses and said, you know what, at this point in time, because if I would have done both those, I would have been the first person to ever do that, first NFL person to do that. And I would have been the oldest person to ever do it at 59. And so I relented and I said, you know what, if I go do Lhotse, I will die. I knew that for sure. I was close to that anyhow, but I knew if I went and did that, it would be a fatal attempt. And it was just like, that record didn't mean anything to me anymore. It was just like, you know, it, you need to move on. And so when I came back to your comment about that post, I had a lot of time to think about life and what's important and my kids, my daughters, two of them. And it's just like, it's not important. And so now I'm, you know, 2 days, you know, I hadn't posted anything in 6 days. And there's so many people that are like, you know, hands up in there and just like, what a victory. And there's no obstacles. And, you know, it was one big, great ride. And look what a stud I am. And I just go, you know what, it would not be authentic of me having gone through all this. And I've really got nothing to prove. Like, you don't, like, you're a big, strong, you know, dude, you're a family man. You have no problem shedding your love for your wife and your kids. And it's just like, I said, I'm just going to keep it real. And if somebody thinks of me as, you know, less because I didn't make my goal of climbing those two mountains, even though I just climbed Mount Everest, you know, I'm just going to keep it real. And, you know, okay, I'm the second NFL guy that's ever done this, but I struggled and I was hurting and I wanted to quit. And there are multiple times when I didn't know if I was actually going to make it through all that. And I just, you know, it was a head game. I just felt compelled just to keep it real and just share what I went through. And, you know, if somebody could relate to that, then awesome. If they can't, then they can't. So
you can't relate to that, then screw off. Right. Like,
yeah,
for me, that's, it's so cool that you have such a massive success, but at the same time with the success, that it was humbling.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that was a really cool humbling. So you've got these two almost divergent experiences coming through, where normally when you have a loss, it's humbling, but you had a massive, massive success, right? Like, only two guys have ever done this thing before. And like, that's, to me, it's just incredible. It's incredible. I don't care which number of the mountain you were, you did it, right? Like, you got to the summit of Mount Everest. Like, people have lost their vision. They've lost their lives. You said you were stepping over dead bodies up there, and that's been well documented. You know, people lose their feet, their fingers, their frostbitten everywhere. And you made a very rational choice, but it also sounds like it came from a really cool place.
Well, not only that. So I told you, thank you for that. Not only did all the things I just told you happen, you know, I started off 12:30 in the morning. Now this would have been the 23rd. It's at night, so you kind of feel like it's the day before, but it was
right.
12:30 at night. I had just a little bit of granola, and we had a 50 mile per hour high wind going left to right. And I ended up getting blind in my it's called snow blindness in my left eye. So I literally couldn't see out of it. And the reason why that, you know, outside of just the hassle of being blind in one eye, why that became so important, that story in my survival, is because unlike all the other mountains, you know, where you're tethered to somebody else, usually it's a four-man rope team, which I've done, you're tethered to the mountain. So they're called fixed lines. And so you're taking a 3-foot extended line, which is wraps around your waist. On the end of that is a carabiner. and I'm clipping into to the fixed line, which is laying on the snow, and then you pull it up and it goes up roughly to your waist, and then you're connected. So if you fall, you know, the mountain will catch you. And so as I got up towards the Hillary Step, which is kind of like the last third of the mountain, it gets super steep and you're in, it's rocky. And so, you know, crampons on rocks don't make a great match. And it's rocky, snowy, and there was dead people. One of the guys was my tent mate from Antarctica, who died in 2019, who he was laying right there. It'd be like, you know, seeing a mannequin with his, all the stuff on, you know, there's Dawn. And as I'm looking down, well, first of all, I'm looking down straight at Tibet, you know, it's just, you know, it's like 20,000 feet straight down. It's, there's
nothing. But you can see it from the mountain.
Oh, you're looking straight down at, you know, because there's the China side from the north, which controls Tibet, and there's the Nepal side from the south. And I went from the south. But for, in terms of my vision, I was having such a challenge at my depth perception of reaching down and tying into the fixed line on this super rocky, super steep, you know, where you've only got like 6 inches to like navigate, you know, through this patch, trying to get to the top. And my Sherpa, who was with me, he couldn't understand English. And so I kept pointing to my eye and he just thought like I was saying, hey, we're having a great time. Right. And I just, I mean, it was just one challenge after the other. And when you're looking down at these fixed lines that are tied in about 50 yards to 100 yard intervals by ice screws before the next one starts. So I'm constantly clipping in, clipping out, clipping in, clipping out. And as I'm looking down, there was about five other ropes that were alongside that rope. And these would have been from 2012, 2016. They're frayed. And so if you click into the wrong line, you know, at some point in time, those things kind of fall off the edge. You know, they're cut somewhere. Right. And so you'd be clipping in, but you're not really in. So you want to make sure you're in the right. So, you know, you've got all this negative energy of I can't clip in, he won't help me, I'm blind in the eye, I'm face whipped on his left, and I've got no energy, right? And so these are all the things that play it in. And then when I finally get down, now this is about 5 o'clock. So I start the journey at 12:30, hadn't eaten all day, had just a little bit of granola out of the door, climb up this mountain. Now it's 5 o'clock the next day. Okay. So that's 18 hours. And so wow. Now I finally crawl into my tent, and about 9 o'clock that night, I ran out of oxygen. And so a Sherpa had come by, or lead Sherpa had come by our tent and said, hey, is everything cool? This is maybe, you know, maybe 10 o'clock. And I go, I've got no oxygen. And so he goes, we ran out, which was bullshit. It was bullshit because I was supposed to, remember, I was supposed to go up Lhotse, and I bought three more oxygen tanks as part of my package, right?
Right.
And so, it'd become very stormy again and high winds and all this stuff. And so the net is he takes off and I'm like left there, and he goes, share with your tent mates. I had two girls on either side of me stuffed in this, three people in this two man tent, very uncomfortable. And I never got any oxygen that night. So I spent the entire night hallucinating, freezing, everything else. And through that hallucination, I was actually trying to crawl out of my tent because I thought I was going to a hot shower in Chicago. I was just all messed up.
Wow.
And so, yeah. And so.
And you're at what, 25,000 feet?
26,500 feet.
26,000. Wow.
Yeah. I spent the entire night with no O's. Slept.
Wow.
And what happens, one of the things that when we were talking about people who have died on Everest or other mountains is that there's something called cerebral edema or pulmonary edema. So one is where there's swelling of the brain, the other one's swelling of the lungs. And this is real. And it's very serious. And a lot of people have died from this.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and what happens is when you get oxygen, you know, you're feeding more O's because you're, you know, like a third of the O's that you normally would have in San Diego. Right. And so I don't know how I survived that. I don't know. You know, I certainly had a bunch of angels sitting on my shoulder that night. But I was not like the normal Mark, and just very fortunate that after going through all the other stuff I'd gone through, that I actually survived the night on the mountain at 26,500 before I started my way down the next morning.
It's interesting because when you're talking about the people with their hands in the air taking the pictures and it's like, I conquered the mountain. It's like, not really. You survived the mountain, right? And that's like, I mean, yes, you summit, which is a monumental feat, but in reality, you're surviving. You're surviving and putting one foot in front of the other. Hoping to escape.
No, well, there's one other point beyond that is that not only are you surviving the mountain, which obviously, you know, is what happened to me and losing all the weight and blindness and all this other stuff. But you've only got halfway there. You still got, you know, you got to go do the same thing, you know, turn around. And that's one of the things where people have said, like, what was it like on the top? Were you up and elation and taking pictures? And, you know, I feel like I missed the boat, but I was so gassed. I couldn't think of doing anything else, but just sitting on my ass and just like, now I've got to go all the way back down. You know, it wasn't that typical thing. I was so consumed about that because again, going down is where you start falling and slipping and everything else. And I had to go back through this, all these treacherous areas, you know, on Mount Everest, where, you know, in the thin air, we've seen different movies on these things. Right. And, you know, it is hairy going down this stuff. And again, my hunger hadn't gone away. I still hadn't eaten, you know, it was like, now what? And so, anyways, a lot of times people get caught up, like you said, they get to the top and like, you know, you've got there, but you're only halfway home and you've still got half a football to play, right?
The story doesn't end when you're at the top. You still have to get down safely. Exactly. Yeah, isn't that crazy? What was the scariest part on the mountain for you?
It was probably around the Hillary step. You know, when we're going through that. And that was probably the scariest part of it, just because that's it, just you're on such thin ridges, you know, it's so steep and you're just almost like on a balance beam of trying to go across that. And actually we're focused. I want to give you a slightly different answer. That was on summit day, you know, when the for sure the most terrifying is going through the Kumba ice fall. And that this is, you know, just out of base camp at 17,500 feet. The goal is to get up to camp one, which is, there's a big gap between 17,500, and then you have to go up 2000 feet to 19,500 to camp one, which we had some tents up there. And if you could imagine going through the twin towers that fell in New York, on 9/11, but rather than have all that steel and twisted stuff that came down, they're all ice towers they go up to like 30 feet, these big gigantic boulders. It's a glacier, and a glacier means it's basically a frozen river. And in this case, when it warms up during the day, it all moves and shifts and collapses.
Oh man.
And so it's literally like a game you'd see on TV where, you know, you're rolling the roulette dice again, and you're going through this. I went through it five times, and all five times, every single time I went through it, there was a different route. You're going deep, 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 deep down in the crevasses. You're climbing, you know, 40 to 60 feet back over these things at any minute, which they did. They collapsed. I was in it by myself. At one point, I'd separated from the Sherpas and all the other climbers, and there was an avalanche that was coming straight at me. And I was just like, I'm done. I'm absolutely done. There was no place I could go. I couldn't run. I couldn't hide. And kind of the last minute, it took a sharp right-hand turn. And this was a massive bunch of snow that was coming down on us. And we had avalanches literally every day. But this one was the one that was actually, I had a couple coming at me, but this seemed like the most real, like this is going to run over me like a freight train. And so going through this and you know, carrying heavy backpacks with gear that was taking up the mountain, and, you know, climbing up, you know, just the amount of strength you needed to pull, and then coming back down through was no picnic either. You know, you had to go back down and navigate and go through all this. And there was one point where I was on a ladder. It was coming down. It was about a 12-foot ladder going from one high point to another. And I leaned back a little bit too much, and the rope slipped out of my hand. And I literally, if you can imagine yourself going upside down, slipping, I fell straight down, you know, and rattling off the ice kind of on the side of me and rattling off the aluminum ladder going as I was, you know, kept going down. And if I hadn't been clipped in to a rope, again, a fixed line attached to this, I would have just kept going down and all these other crevasses. And who knows if I'd be sitting here today, but it, you know, I was bloodied up and it was like I had taken a big hit going over the center and my back was all wiped out, but I survived it. I don't know how, but I survived it. I didn't break anything and I was rattled, but got back up and it was like, man, I need to pay way more attention to this.
It's so there's such an element of fate to it, right? Where nobody knows when one of these big glaciers are going to fall or it's going to float or, you know, the sun comes out and like nobody knows. Right. So every day you wake up for 70 days and you've got the chance of getting smashed by an avalanche or a ladder breaking or a rope, you know, there's a myriad of things that could go wrong on the mountain. When you wake up in the morning, I don't know if you're spiritual or not. It's because most of the time we go through our life, right? And it's like, you know, pretty ho-hum. I expect most days I'm going to make it through. I'm not going to get hit by a bus. And, you know, I don't like wake up with an immense gratitude that I'm alive today. It's like, I try my best to. We have a gratefulness practice and, you know, I pray every night and all that. But it's like, still, you get kind of like in the rhythm and it's like, yeah, I expect to be here till I'm 80 or 90 or whatever, right? And we're just kind of go about our business. But mm-hmm. you have moments where you wake up for almost 70 straight days where you're like, well, I hope this isn't my last day, right? It's like, how do you in your head reconcile that and just keep going?
Well, you know, over the course, there's been a lot of friends and family really concerned. And, you know, I think there's another element the way I look at this too. I mean, I would say just in terms of like where I really had to call the angels together and protect me was certainly on Summit Day, because that's where I, like I said before, I really felt like I took myself to the edge of like I could have just easily just, you know, rolled over and slept and probably never woken up again, you know, and that's what a number of people have done.
That happens, right? Yeah.
That seriously happens. And, you know, I think there's another element and it's kind of like, why not me? And, you know, if I go back to when I was sitting, and you can identify with this for sure. You know, I was a seventh round draft pick in 1995, and I'm sitting in the first training camp during the spring, and all the veterans are in there. And 2 years before, they'd won the Super Bowl, and there was all these legends in there. You know, Marcus Allen and El Zato and Howie Long and Lester Hayes and Jim Plunkett and all these guys, right, that would later become friends of mine. But I'm sitting in this room and Tom Flores, our head coach, gets up and you know, he goes, hey, I know there's kind of all fun and games. In those days, you know, we had like 150 free agents and, you know, new guys and draft picks and everything else in the room, plus all the guys from the year before. And he goes, I know this is, you know, it's all fun and games and, you know, I'm glad you guys were all here, but just understand that at the end of this, you know, in September, we're going to cut 100 people and there's going to be 55 of you sitting here. And so, I, you know, and the odds were like seriously stacked against me. And I looked around the room and I just was like, you know, I don't know who you're talking about, but, you know, why not me? Why can't I be that guy? Right. Same thing I said in college. Why can't I be that one that, you know, breaks the rules and makes the team and overcomes the odds? And the same thing happened to me. On this, and in particular on this particular mountain, but when I first had talked about the seven summits and it became more and more and more and more and more real, with Everest, and people say, why are you doing this? You know, it's selfish. You're going to die. Well, you know, there's people die every day walking down the street and they get in car wrecks and these crazy shootings they have and being in the wrong place at the right time. I said, why not me? Why can't I be that one guy, that one NFL guy, now two, second person, why can't I be that guy that makes it? Why do I have to die? I don't have to die. And then that falls back on process and, you know, what you have to do to put yourself in the best position of success to actually follow through on why you can answer the question, why not me? You can't just say, why not me? And this, you know, throw dice. it's one on me. And then you have to go through that process. And for me, it's always been from something I learned from my college coach, Don James, who taught me about the pyramid of success. At the very top of the pinnacle of that pyramid was competitive greatness. And competitive greatness is about those 25 different individual and team blocks that make up all the things that you have to do. And in my case, it took me 10 years to get to Everest. That's not like a short-term goal. And the reason why I think I've ultimately succeeded in all this, there was a little bit of luck on weather, but why I succeeded on this is because I absolutely, and I know you do too, love the process of trying to make myself better, of physically challenging myself, of being not just physically better, but on the spiritually better, nutrition-wise, all those things that kind of feed your body, that puts yourself in the best position of succeeding in whatever thing that you want to do in life. And that's really been my secret to, I think, where I've gotten in some of these different things.
Did you, I know when we left Kilimanjaro, for me, the whole experience was, it left me with a lot, but it was, you don't have to, you get to, right? It's like, you go through cool moments like that and you get some type of message that comes to you. For me, is you don't have to, you get to do everything in life. And it's just kind of a mindset shift. Did you get anything like that coming off of Everest?
Well, appreciation for life, certainly a big time. Yeah. But I want to go back to that magical time that we had in on Kilimanjaro.
Yeah.
And what that I had when I first started my first trail at Kilimanjaro, and that would have been 3 or 4 years before that. I say, I'm going there and put together this little fundraiser and raised 10 grand for this Boys and Girls. I didn't really immerse myself that much, but I think what that really taught me about going on that trip with you, which was for the listener, there's Water Boys, that we were asked to be part of this first class to go down there and climb Kilimanjaro, raise a bunch of money, and go out and visit these people and build these water wells so these poor girls didn't have to walk, 3 to 5 miles with buckets on their head of filling up water and coming back and having bad things happen to them. But their high degree of gratefulness that we felt and their appreciation for what we did. I mean, we were treated like the Beatles, when we walked in that camp. It was crazy, right? And so it was just kind of, I guess the transformation of, passion with purpose, right? And so I have an extreme passion of all things working out and bettering myself. But the purpose ultimately was, how can I help my daughter who has epilepsy heal? And what can I do to help others? And that's been kind of the magic trigger that, they talk about paying it forward. I started a campaign called Millions Everest, and we raised a bunch of money, and the NFL threw a bunch of money into it and the Raiders. And I'm so grateful. But at the end of the day, it's just like, how can you take what you're already doing and shove it, or redirect it to a higher ground and higher purpose of what we all should really be on this earth to be doing. And that's helping others. And not only am I helping Amelia, but also these other military people. And I tell you what, since we started this campaign, and there's been quite a bit of attention around that, my daughter, for the first time, the last 5 months, she's not had one seizure. And I believe that's because the empowerment that we've given her, the way that we've promoted Amelia's Everest, her name, the fact that we've had these huge organizations, Higher Ground, but the Raiders, the NFL, Social Grant Department, stepping out and having her as kind of that spokesman has made her fly high, stand taller, and have those wings. And this is not scientific, but I don't know what the other reason would be, but it's so grateful that I was really taught that lesson on what Chris Long was doing by helping others and empowering those small communities, that what can I do to do kind of the same thing, but in my own way, and at the same time, help my daughter.
That's so beautiful and good for her. Good for you guys. I mean, that is how great is that? And you're right. There's, you can't put science to that. It's not possible to put science to that, but the empowerment of it all and the mental shift that it's wild what the brain can do. and what belief and hope and having other people believe in you and sending all their thoughts your way and prayers. I mean, that's, it's really powerful stuff.
And the other thing too, that if nobody hears anything else that we've talked about today, you know, and going back to your first question, like you were asking, how did you get into climbing? And I came from a place where I was a wounded bird, right? But we all, it doesn't matter. That was my story, but we all go through patches that are tough, right? And the question is, what are you going to do to get out of it and move your life forward in a positive way? And what the mountains did first and foremost is help me heal. It gave me calm. It gave me peace. You know, being out obviously in nature, your phone's not buzzing off the hook and doing all those things. And it helped me just get regrounded and where I wanted to go. And things are flying high today and all those things happen. And then along the way, I was able to like be in a place where I could like think about how I could positively affect, you know, others. And then there's this kind of, over these 10 years, there's been this shift, like the meter has gone from poor Mark to like, you know, great things. And again, as I said, you know, take some of this press I've been getting, which now they all interweave the foundation, Higher Ground and Amelia and all that kind of stuff. And so it's just been so cool to see that. And like you, you know, you've had your 15 minutes of fame, you know, like me way back when. And, you know, I didn't really know how to handle it in terms of paying it forward. And I'm so much more aware because of mentors like Chris, who helped me see what, you know, if you think big enough, you can take this thing to a whole different level.
And that's awesome too, to say Chris is a mentor and you're how much older than him? 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, 20, maybe 22
and
years.
By the way, I don't think you know this story, but when we were sitting on top of the mountain on Mount Kilimanjaro, and we're sitting in the green sign that says you're at the top of the, you know, the world, in Africa, I put my arm around Chris. It was just Chris and I sitting there, and I put my arm around Chris. I said, you know, Chris, there's not too many people who can say they played football with your dad and they summited Kilimanjaro with you.
How cool is that?
It was really cool.
That is so cool. I tell Chris this a lot whenever I talk to him. It's like, I hope my boys can be like you. And I hope that someday, like you, right? It's like, I can learn from Chris and what more can we do and how more can we help? But beyond that, I hope my boys can turn out like Chris, because he really is an amazing human.
Yeah. And, but at the same time, like we all, like I see you in that same vein, like you, because you're a man of your word, you're committed to what you do. Your priorities are not out being in a bar. Your priorities are to your rock star wife, who I mentioned before, and your two boys. You know, you actually moved from, San Diego, California to somewhere in the Midwest, you know, just to have probably a more grounded existence, you know, for your family. Yeah. And you know, like that is your priority. And that's right now where your priority should be.
Last one. We're wrapping it up here, Mark. I know coming like out of games or out of seasons, there's a big letdown, right? It's like, there's kind of that exaltation, but then you're kind of like, what now? And it's, has there been a letdown? Have you reached like a stagnant place?
No, it's a great question. You know, I'm in the work and I'm an executive for Sports Illustrated. So that keeps me plenty busy, but you know, I've been in kind of this healing process and I'm still in it. You know, we talked earlier about losing 25 pounds and of those 25, I'm about, you know, I'm still down about 12, 13 pounds. And so I'm trying to like fight back in the game on that. And, you know, I've got some cool things going on. Jim and I are emceeing a big fundraiser here. Their goal is to raise $1 million and we're kind of, you know, helping be kind of out in front. General Matias is actually the guest speaker. So they got a big prominent person through Higher Ground. And then the NFL is doing a documentary on this whole journey that I've been through and Amelia's Everest and all this stuff. And so that comes out in September. So I'm helping them aggregate all the content. So that would be cool. That'll be on all the NFL channels, and they're going to have a premiere, big premiere here in Sun Valley in September. And then in terms of the physical, you know, it's just like preparation meets opportunity, and I'm repairing my body. I'm starting to work out twice a day again. I love it. That's why I do it like you. And, you know, I'm thinking about smaller mountains right now. I didn't realize this, and I think this would be a really cool goal, but trying to climb the highest mountain in every state. So states like Illinois, that's open the door and tap the ground.
Yeah, that's going to be easy here in Indiana.
Yeah, but what a great way to come out and, like, you know, see.
That's right.
You know, different states. And, you know, so I've done four of the hardest ones, you know, up in Alaska, up in Washington, in California, and here in Idaho. And there's other tough ones too, in Colorado and Utah and places like that. But, you know, they're not 2 month ventures, and I don't want to do anything more that involves suffering. Now I'm done suffering. Hard things, you know, day hikes, you know, going to Mount Rainier, and maybe there are 3 day overnights in a tent, but this long extended away from your family, I don't want to do that anymore.
Yeah. You've done it.
I've done it.
Well accomplished. Mark, hey, thank you so much for the time and congratulations. It's just a massive undertaking. I mean, for 10 years. So not for the 70 days, but for all the mountains you've climbed, all the work you've done, the workouts that you put into it, the spirituality, the mental toughness training, the way you live your life. Congrats. It's awesome. And obviously it's not slowing down, because guys like you don't slow down.
You know, it's really taught me a lot about life, and that's really about setting big goals and going after them and not letting, you know, negative voices get in your ear, why you can't do this, why you shouldn't do certain things. And it's had just a huge impact. And, you know, it's just like, I have this saying that I put up in my little personal gym, and it takes a little more to make a champion. And I believe if you want to go the extra distance, you know, you got to do those certain things that will make you a champion. And that's what separates you from those who do and those who do not.
I love it, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're glad you're back.
I'm glad I have my life back, my 10 years, everything else. But hey, listen, and congratulations to you. You're really good at this, and it's not easy. You make it seem easy in terms of a fantastic conversationalist, asking all the right questions. And I wish nothing but success for you in the future. And, you know, hopefully we can connect one of these days in person.
We will, Mark. Thank you. And tell Jim hi, please.
I sure will this afternoon.
Right on.
All right, buddy. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Believe Network. If you liked this podcast, be sure to subscribe and check us out on Believe.com and follow us on Instagram and Twitter and like us on Facebook. That's BLEAV. Do you believe?